Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe for this very special event this evening, the book launch of Brain Briefs by Dr. Art Markman and Dr. Bob Duke. Very, very exciting. But, you know, there's a book going around, right, that we're asking people to sign, which Judith has right here.
Reverse book signing.
Reverse book signing. But to start out this evening, I would love for you to read a little bit from the book, which I have for you.
You know, I love
for you.
I have to tell you, she said this backstage, and I thought, this is so weird, but I will do it because I do everything Rebecca tells me.
What are we reading?
But
from?
I have to. But she didn't mark the page
to where boyfriend. We're...
Do you know which one it is? Oh, yeah. Here we go. 177. God, look at all these pages.
I know.
Amazing.
Something.
An infinite number of monkeys.
Okay. Like I said, this is kind of weird, but we're going with it because the producer said to do it. this is a lovely chapter that Art wrote, but he refers to himself in the second person, so I'm going to read it so it doesn't sound weird. A couple of years ago... This is called How Do We Decide What to Buy? A couple of years ago, Art had to buy a new coffee maker. He went to the local Bed Bath & Beyond, a cavernous retailer of things for the home, where he was confronted with an entire section devoted to coffee makers. The array of features was dizzying. Cone, filter, basket, K-cup, different sizes, automatic timer, glass or metal carafe. There must have been over 30 to choose from. There were so many options, it quickly became clear that Art was not going to have a peak coffee maker experience. He nearly ran out of the store screaming. There was simply no way to figure out which model was the best one for him, at least not without a detailed guide explaining which features mattered and a few days to consider all the options carefully, or perhaps a coffee maker concierge to provide assistance and advice. Ultimately, Art grabbed the 12-cup coffee maker with a cone filter that looked like it probably wouldn't fall apart too quickly. He recognized the brand names, so he assumed it would probably be reasonably well-made. He spent about 10 minutes figuring out what to buy. And after using his purchase for several years, Art is happy to report that the coffee maker still makes a pretty decent cup of coffee, and his decision seems to have been a good one. This example says a lot about how we normally shop. Most of the products we buy are things we know very little about. We may have heard the names of a few manufacturers, and we may have in mind a couple of features that matter to us, but a lot of the subtle differences among products are not things most people know about or even care about. So how do we figure out what to buy? The explanation offered by economic theories of decision-making suggests that we make choices by considering each of the features of a product, including price, figuring out how useful the features are, assigning relative weights to the features in terms of their importance. I'm laughing because this doesn't make any sense. And adding the total usefulness, what economists call utility. The item with the highest utility is the one we choose, in theory. It's a tidy, seemingly reasonable explanation, but in most cases, it's not how things actually work. In most circumstances, evaluating each aspect of a product and weighing the features against its cost is far too time-consuming for us humans to carry out, especially in today's crowded, fast-paced world. Most of us have neither sufficient knowledge nor patience to evaluate each option carefully. Instead, we use the readily accessible information in our environment and in our memories. And one of the things that I think this little snippet illustrates is the things about the way we behave that are not intuitive. What this sort of speaks to in a very, I think, interesting example is we sort of bank on the idea that we're making all of our decisions based on rational thinking and that we're weighing different options and we're thinking about, well, how much does this matter and how much does that matter, when really our emotions are involved at a level that most of us are loath to admit. And that's something that I think we should probably talk about a little bit tonight.
And we will talk about it because the basis of doing this show was we wanted to try to get at how we think. You know, we wanted to understand how we think, why we do the things we do, why we think the things we think. But I want to back up just a little bit before we get to this question, answering this question, and talk a little bit about writing the book. Because putting the radio show together is one thing. We get together, we talk for 45 minutes, a couple hours, whatever. And then I kind of cut it together into a 7-minute piece. But when you guys said last year, we're going to write a book, Art said he was going to write a book. Every couple of months I would hear how the book was coming along, but I had no idea how you were finding time to put it together or what your process was. So talk a little bit about the idea, coming up with the idea to write the book, and then working on it and what that was like.
Right. So as far as the idea for writing the book, it was partly I had written Smart Thinking and Smart Change, and my agent said it was time to write another book, and I was out of smart ideas, right? I mean, so that was the, and so, but actually he pointed out that there was a book that had come out. The guy who writes the XKCD comic online, if you've ever seen that, it's kind of a science-based comic. It's very, very cool. And he had a book called Why, that was a bunch of random answers to scientific questions. And he said, that would be fun. Don't you do a show? why don't you do something sort of like that, only about psychology and related to the show? And so I talked to Bob, and he said, okay. I think that was the genesis.
Yeah, that was our planning.
That was the planning meeting. And then it turns out, you know, the sort of the old Jack Sprat rhyme, Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean. It turns out I really like to fill blank pages, and Bob really likes to edit stuff that's been written.
It was a perfect match.
Exactly.
So I would like fill pages with the equivalent of the 45-minute conversation that we have before each show, and then Bob would hack at it and try and turn it into something that was semi-coherent.
Well, and you know, I think one of the things about that, you know, actually there is an essay in the book about writer's block, and one of the things that many people fail to understand about just generating stuff on your own is we think that some inspiration needs to well up inside of us, and then we just can't wait to get that out onto the page or on the
screen.
You think
what you're writing needs to be good.
Yeah, exactly. he's not really kidding, because the thing is, what happens when you actually generate things that are good is you generate stuff, and not all of it's good. And one of the things that we human beings do, especially people who don't write a lot for a living, think carefully as we're writing how good what we're writing actually is. That is the death of writers. And what Art understands very well is, you know, I just got to get stuff on a page. And Art is really good. I mean, he blogs for, you know, Harvard Business Review and Psychology Today and probably other things I don't even know about. But he generates text like really fast. I mean, I still sit in awe of Art's ability to generate text. But the thing that's important about this, about doing anything where you have to actually create something on your own, is rather than waiting until you think of something good, you just start generating things on your own. Now, that seems really non-intuitive. But the only reason it seems non-intuitive is the things that we see that people have generated have gone through many iterations of editing and refinement. And we think, well, my God, it just came out just like that. Well, actually, it didn't come out anything like that, right? It came out entirely different. And after many iterations and a lot of back and forths, and Art and I really like each other, so he doesn't mind when I rip things up and move them around and do all that kind of stuff. We're still friends. That creates a different kind of product at the end. And many people who I think are sort of inhibited by not really trying things like that are so because they're thinking about, I shouldn't put anything down unless I'm sure it's going to be good. That's a huge mistake.
And one of the things that was really fascinating about doing this project in particular is, you know, I mean, Bob and I have written a lot of stuff over the course of our careers. We've written, you know, academic prose that's written in a, you know, in a very high register, and we've written,
I think that's
highfalutin is where this is,
yeah,
Texas
highfalutin register, yeah.
And we've written, you know, somewhat more casual things, but this was kind of an interesting project, right? Because we have this show that involves a conversation, and it's somewhat lighthearted, and it's somewhat generally we hope to make it easy to understand. But we didn't want to write like a script, you know, Bob says, then Art says, that was awkward. So one of the hardest things was to try to, I mean, and neither of us are, you know, fiction writers, so we don't spend a lot of time thinking about voice and all that kind of stuff. And so the hard part was, how do you come up with something that has both, the character of being somewhat easy to understand and lighthearted, while still also having relatively personal kinds of stories from the two of us. And so, you know, in the snippet that you read, I mean, what we ended up doing was referring to ourselves in the third person, which we won't do here.
Art
won't do that here. And neither will Bob. But it was interesting. I mean, the whole process of kind of getting to that really did require, you know, we didn't sit there and say, well, we have to solve that problem before we write anything. You know, it was really just, let's write a bunch of stuff. And at some point, this will somehow become clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is really interesting because that's kind of how we go about doing the show. You know, we sit down and I'm like, you know what happened to me this week? Chloe just will not go between.
Fill in the blank.
Whatever it is that I'm trying to get her to do. My daughter. Whatever it is, she won't do it. And so we talk about parenting. We talk about what we see on the news. We talk about road rage. We talked about kinds of things.
My favorite is Hawk sticking his head in the office one day and saying, well, someone explain to me why people insist on having four-hour meetings.
And we did
he left the room and we went, listener Hawk Mendenhall asks if size matters when it comes to meetings.
True.
That never made it on the air, but I was particularly happy with that.
I had to take that out. I had to edit that. But I want to know, you know, I really want to know about your process, like how you go about writing this stuff. You know, do you sit down? Do you make time? Do you prioritize to write? Because you write a lot.
I try not to schedule anything in the first hour or so of the day, harder to do than I'd like it to be. But and then that's, I get a lot of that writing done sort of in that first, you know, I check a couple of emails and then I try to dive into getting some stuff written. And
just
and,
like over coffee or like
no,
when you
just,
wake
well,
up?
Well, like a coffee what? Next to me and, you know, just try and sitting at my office, sitting at my desk and just try and get something out on the page. It really is that bit. It's just getting something out on the page, knowing that that isn't set in stone. It's just on a word processor. It's easy to change it later. Seriously, I mean, Bob loves to edit stuff and he knows I have no particular attachment to anything that I wrote. And so, you know, I'll believe it's all mine later anyhow. So,
you know, there's a wonderful study that we cite a lot with things like that by Herb Simonton. Herb, was that Herb Simonton's first name? I don't remember. Herb? Simonton? Dean Simonton? Yeah, Dean Simonton. He looked at the productivity of psychologists who had written really important papers. And he looked at over the careers of psychologists and comparing psychologists to one another. And what he found is that the psychologists who wrote more important papers wrote more papers. Now, you know, you'd like to think, we tend to think, because we know of certain psychologists, because they've written important papers, that they only write important papers. But actually, they write a lot of papers, many of which are not important. But I think that should give hope to all of us human beings, you know, that the idea that the people who are actually coming up with things that people say, that's terrific, come up with lots of things. And, you know, the thing I was referring to earlier about the reticence that many of us have to just do something, right? Because we're not sure how good it's going to be, and we're making all kinds of evaluations before we even get started. That keeps you from actually generating good things. And I think what, you know, what we've found, I mean, Rebecca's not kidding when she says those little 7 minutes of loveliness because of her really come out of 45 minutes of Art and I blathering, you know, and somehow it turns into, you know, some cogent thing for 7 minutes. But the reason that's important to think about is that there's a lot of stuff that we talk about. Most of the stuff we talk about never makes it on the air, never makes it into the podcast. And that's an important sort of emblematic thing of the way creativity in general works.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to recognize that we often edit ourselves because we compare ourselves to the final products that we see, whether it's the books that we read or the things that we hear on the radio or whatever, without ever hearing the first draft.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you could read the first drafts of things, I mean, I think it was great that Harper Lee's book got published this year, if only because then we got to see sort of what was essentially the first draft.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. And then we went, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, it needed a lot of work, didn't it?
You know, and I don't often recommend autobiographies. I'm not a big autobiography fan, but James Michener wrote an autobiography. I think it's called My Place in the World, I think. But the most memorable part of that autobiography, and it was really thick, was
imagine what he started with.
Yeah, right. is that there is a page of text that Michener published in the book that he had submitted to his editor, and then there's an image of the pages that came back from the editor with all the changes. And I think there are a couple iterations of that. And then it shows the actual printed copy from, I don't know which novel it was that he was writing about. But the edited copy finally bore only a faint resemblance to what it actually started out being. And I think, you know, a lot of people who think, well, I'm not creative, you know, I really don't kind of come up with things on my own, are underestimating their capabilities, because they're looking, as Art was saying, they're looking at the finished product and comparing what their first draft is to that. And that's an unfair comparison for you, right?
Or you could be like Billie Holiday, and when she was asked about her autobiography, she said, well, you'll have to tell me what's in it. I'd love to know. One day.
That's a different issue.
That's a different issue. Art, what was kind of the impetus of your interest in the brain and human behavior?
Yeah, this is great, because the only thing I think I like talking about better than talking about psychology is talking about myself. So...
they're so modest. I don't know. It's one of the things.
There's a chapter on narcissism in the book. It's funny. I had never considered anything related to psychology growing up, and you know, wasn't one of these people who thought, oh, the mind is that mystery I need to solve. But I got to college, and as I like to say, I thought I would study either economics or physics, and I took economics and I didn't like it, and I took physics and it didn't like me. And about the middle of my sophomore year in college, when I had to declare a major, I was sitting in an advisor's office, and she said, well, what do you want to major in? I said, I have no idea. She said, well, what have you taken that you liked? I said, well, you know, I took a lot of computer science and I liked it, but I don't really want to be a computer scientist. And I took some philosophy and I liked that, but I don't want to really be a philosopher. And I took a neuroscience class. I thought that was cool, but I don't really want to be a neuroscientist. I took a psychology class. I liked that. I don't really want to. And I kept going through. And she said, you know, all of these classes you mentioned count for a major in cognitive science. Is it possible you're a cognitive scientist? And I thought, maybe. And I declared a major in cognitive science and took very few psychology classes. But I had this formative experience where I took mostly computer science. And back in the 1980s, computers were sort of slow and stupid. And I was taking an artificial intelligence class. And we read a paper in which there was a study in it, a study with people in it. And the professor made a disparaging comment about that. And all of the other students in the class laughed, and I proceeded to say, stop. And I gave this impassioned defense of doing research on people if you want to understand intelligent behavior. And about halfway through that diatribe, as everyone in the class is staring at me in horror, I thought, maybe I'm a psychologist. And I applied to graduate school in psychology and kind of took off from there.
But what about, you know, in your childhood, what did it mean to be a psychologist or to be a professor? Kind of what kind of ideas of this profession did you have when you were just a little kid?
You know, I mean, psychologists were people who helped people. I mean, I think the popular view of psychology to this day is that psychologists are the people who you go to for help, which is why, you know, if I'm on an airplane, somebody says, what do you do? What do you teach? Oh, psychology. Then they immediately clam up and say, oh, you're analyzing me. And I have to say, no, I don't care about your problems. But that was my image of what a psychologist was, and I really had no particular image of what a professor was, except that when I got to college, they scared me to death. I mean, literally, I remember waiting outside of a professor's office hours because I had to ask a question and having to catch my breath. I was so intimidated by the professors. Yeah, if I only knew.
What about you, Bob? How did you get started with this?
My entire life is a series of accidents, as many people's
not,
lives.
Not from the beginning.
From the very beginning, actually.
The very
Actually,
beginning.
I was going to start with the fact that when I was born, my dad was 50. And of course, to have a child when you're 50 and a boy when you're 50 is, you know, little boys are inscrutable no matter the age of the parent. But for a 50-year-old parent, they're really inscrutable. And my dad's education ended at eighth grade, and his career was to get a job. And so when people figured out I was smart, he thought, boy, this is going to be great. So all through my life, my dad told me education is the most important thing in the world. And he thought I was going to be an attorney because I like to talk. You know, people thought he'd like a talk attorney. That'd be great. And I remember my senior year in high school sitting at the dinner table with my mom sitting there and my dad sitting there. And I said, Dad, I don't think I want to be an attorney. And he perked up because he's thinking surgeon, you know? And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I think I want to be a music teacher. You know? Yeah, oh boy, I heard somebody say that, right? So, you know, we're passing vegetables for a long time in silence, you know? And then my dad asked an inevitable question that somebody born in 1905 would ask. He said, well, what do music teachers make, you know? And of course, I was 17 years old. I said, Dad, they make $8,000 a year. And I thought, God, how could you even spend $8,000 a year? It's like an unbelievable amount of money. And of course, he thought I was going to completely just, you know, waste all my intellectual capacity on this, you know, profession that wasn't worthy of me. But actually, I became a music teacher, and I played music for a living. And you know, I think, you know, as my dad saw more of my life experience and saw how absolutely wonderful my life was, as I perceived it, he thought that was a pretty cool thing, even though I didn't have a lot of money. But the whole college thing, not on my radar screen at all. I went to, I was teaching school in Atlanta, and a guy who was one of the percussion professors at Indiana started a doctoral program. He said, you know, we got to find somebody. So he called my former teacher and said, I'm looking for some people to populate this doctoral program. So I went to Indiana University and I was a doctoral student. And I thought to myself one day in a practice room about in October, I was practicing and I said, you know, I'm getting a doctorate in drums. This doesn't seem good, you know? And so I left and I went back to where I'd gone to undergraduate school at Florida State in Tallahassee, which had a very, not only a lovely music program, but had a music therapy program and a very tight connection to the psychology department at Florida State. And so I spent a lot of time with people in psychology and people studying abnormal psychology and all different kinds of things. And I found that was a lovely and interesting thing. And I've always been interested in people, you know, and how people work. And being a teacher, you can't be incurious about how people work and work with that many children on a given day. And this college thing just came up completely by accident. I mean, I had no clue that I would do this or that. And I think that's true of many people's experiences. You know, I teach a class for freshmen who are, you know, as clueless as I was as a freshman. And I think many of them come to college with a great deal of pressure to know what's going to happen and to have the whole thing all planned out, you know. And I bring in guests every week who have all different kinds of life experiences, right? And out of a 15-week semester, one out of the 15 people knew they were going to be doing what they were doing when they were freshmen in college. And what's interesting to me is how much the freshmen are so relieved by that. You know, like, God, I don't have to have this all figured out, you know. And I think a lot of what interests Art and me and you too, you know, on the show and the things that we talk about are the actual vicissitudes of life that lead us in ways that we never imagined we would go, you know. And I think that's one of the cool things about life experiences, especially, you know, in a privileged society like we live in, where we're not under constant threat of harm and, you know, worrying about where we're going to get our next meal and those kind of things. I mean, we live in a pretty privileged society. And in that sense, we have lots of opportunities that can lead us to places that we never would have imagined. And I think one of the things I know Art does with his students who are undergraduates here, and I do with my students here too, is try to get them to imagine possibilities that they've not considered before. You know, and I think that's true for a lot of adults too. I mean, you kind of get in a place and you get in a groove and you get in a job and you get in a thing. You think, well, this is it, you know. And actually, there are lots of opportunities that, again, those of us who live in a privileged society, I mean, you guys are coming out on a Tuesday night. You've decided to choose us instead of Mike Pence and Tim Kaine. Shocking.
Is that still going on?
I know. shocking though that may be. And you know, I mean, I mean that you even imagine, well, that would be an interesting thing to go to. I mean, I think a lot of people don't take opportunities like that.
Yeah. I mean, and both of these ideas of, like, you know, who are you going to become and all of this stuff, it leads to these questions, especially as a parent, because I have an 8-year-old and I'm thinking, like, I want her to think she can do anything, you know? But where does that kind of set? How do expectations for your children shape who they're going to become and how they're going to navigate the world?
So, I mean, one of the fascinating things about teaching at a university is the breadth of topics that people can study, not just the breadth of research that's going on, but also the breadth of things that students can get involved in. And most of the things that students can get involved in, which may still lead them in all sorts of interesting places in the rest of their lives, those things are things that don't enter into common conversation in the typical dining room in America. And so what that means is a lot of our students come to UT with a fairly narrow set of expectations about what they might possibly do with the rest of their lives. I mean, my dad's an accountant, so my set of beliefs were I could be an accountant, a lawyer, or a doctor. Right? Those were my three options. Cognitive scientist was not on the radar, and still probably isn't on the radar for a lot of people. And I think that what happens is if you allow yourself to be defined by a set of labels that you're given early in life, and then you try to make the rest of the things that you do comport with those labels, you can edit out a lot of experiences that might be really deep and informative and might push you in directions you had never considered before. And I think, you know, I think Bob would agree with this. You know, neither of us had the imagination to think we would do most of the things that we've ended up doing in our lives, including being on the radio. I don't think either of us ever thought, gosh, someday I would... Wouldn't
someday
it be cool
I'll be on KUT?
On the KUT, you know, and so if you then edit your life experience based on what you were able to imagine in the forward direction, you edit out cool things like being on the radio, right? And so I think one of the things that we have to do is to recognize that while it's valuable to have some idea about what you might want to do in the future, at all stages, you still need to allow life to prove to you that it's far more interesting than anything you can come up with.
And I think another part of that, too, is that we, I think, often have the misperception that there are a relatively narrow band of things that people could be good at and like. You know, the phrase comes around all the time. I just hate this phrase. You know, find your passion. Like it's in a closet somewhere.
No, that's the gum.
You're gonna open the closet and go, "Dad, there it is." You know,
no, those are the genes.
but actually, you know, what you come to love are the things that you invest in, right? I mean, it's not that you can love anything, but you can love a lot of things. And I think once somebody embarks on the world as a young person, thinking about, I've got to find the one thing that's going to make me feel good and feel rewarding and feel like I'm doing something meaningful. We now, as Art's saying, just limit things in a way that's very disadvantageous for the individual, because a lot of us could enjoy doing lots of different things. I mean, I love interacting with other people. Now, I'm a teacher. I do things related to psychology. I do science. I do research. All those things involve people things. I could do lots of different things. I can imagine myself being very happy doing, you know. I started my career as a music teacher in a public school. I could still be doing that and be very happy. And the reason I'm doing this is not because this was my real passion and I found it and I got out of that other thing that wasn't my, I mean, I could have retired doing that, but I'm happy that I'm doing this too. And I think that's true for most of our experiences. Again, I have to say, given the fact that we're in a pretty privileged society where we have lots of opportunities.
And just to add one more thing to that, I mean, I think labels are dangerous. And we've talked on the show before about this idea that when you label something, that label carries an essence with it, so that now you can come to believe, oh, I'm a psychologist, therefore I have essence of psychologist, which means that there are certain things I should pay attention to, like psychology experiments, but certain things maybe I shouldn't, like things that are going on in computer science or history or English, because I'm not an English professor, I'm a psychologist. And if you don't believe in essences, here's the way to think of this. You can use essences as an insult, right? So you can say, is John a painter? Well, he paints. Right? And that works because what is a painter except somebody who paints? But if you say, well, he paints, what you're saying is, well, he does the action, but he's missing that thing that would make him a painter. And I think that when you label yourself and then come to believe, oh, I've got essence of that thing, it causes you to close off other opportunities. And you know, the beauty of having the chance to study and talk about humanity and the human experience, individuals, groups, cultures, all of these things, is that is such a complicated topic that almost every discipline out there in the world has something to give you insight into it, which means that if you're open to it, reading a great work of literature, or reading a piece of history, or reading philosophy, or psychology experiments, or sociology, or anthropology, or any one of a number of other disciplines, actually provides you with new ways of understanding this problem that are all fair game, as long as you don't believe the label that you put on yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get back to, like, speaking of this, and I want to get back to something you mentioned when you first started answering this question, which was, this isn't something you talked about around the dinner table, which gives us this sense that there is something about our childhood which sets in place the people who we're going to be in the future. And I wonder, you know, like, I think that is a myth in psychology that a lot of who we are is shaped in childhood, but how much of that myth is reality? How much of our childhood experiences, our childhood understandings of who we are and who we can be actually do shape who we become?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think we have to stipulate that we come with a lot of stuff already before we experience anything, right? I mean, our genetic predispositions have a tremendous influence on how we respond to the world around us. And, you know, when people talk about the so-called nature versus nurture debate, that's the wrong way to frame the question, right? Science writer Matt Ridley wrote a great book because of the title, and the title of Ridley's book was Nature Via Nurture, right? I mean, we have predispositions, and those predispositions may influence how we behave and how we make decisions and those kinds of things, given the experiences that we have. Some of those predispositions will be entirely invisible because we will never have any experiences that bring any of those to the surface. So that's this kind of, and anybody who's raised more than one child in your home knows that this is the case, right? I mean, it's the same family, same dinner table where I'm feeding them the same food, and there's that kid, and there's that kid. Now, how is that?
You know? I was always that kid.
Yeah, yeah. There's the kid who that won't kid. Even come to the table.
That was you. Yeah,
exactly. So I mean, we have to stipulate that at the outset, right? But I mean, certainly the experiences that we have influence what we're going to be and how we behave. I think that the thing that's changed in our thinking in psychology is giving so much credence to parental experiences, how we experience life with our parents and how we experience life with our peers, because of course our peers have a tremendous influence, and as we move into early adolescence and late adolescence, certainly all of us who have raised teenagers and all of us who have been teenagers, which is everybody in the room, knows that those people come to matter a lot. But one of the things that I think about when you raise that question is what it means to be a child when adults are interested in you. I think one of the privileges that all of us had sitting up here, I know, as children, is that our parents were generally interested in us. You know, we would come home, and I actually had meals with my parents, and they would ask me questions, right, about what happened to me that day. Now, that's a really daunting thing to think about because, you know, I'm a little kid, and here are these adults, and they have jobs, and they're supporting me, and they're asking me what happened to me that day as if they actually care about it. that's a tremendous thing for a child to experience in a way that I think many children who don't experience that grow up with a very different perspective about how much risk to take in their lives, how secure they feel in uncertain situations and those kinds of things. I mean, I often tease my daughter who has two lovely grandchildren that live here in Austin, and my wife and I are very privileged to have that experience with them all the time. But you know, whenever grades come out, my daughter, when I'm at their house, will say, well, Ella, go get your grade report and show it to Pop. And Ella will come in the grade report. And there's all A's on it, you know. And I'm thinking, look, three of your four grandparents are college professors. Your mother's a teacher. Your father's an electrical engineer. Making good grades in school is not an accomplishment. You know what I mean? I mean, what are we talking about here, right? And what I want for her, what I want for my grandchildren, is that they recognize that they don't have to follow a path that people may inadvertently or purposefully say, this is what you need to do, right? I mean, there are opportunities that they have to do things that might not be on anybody's radar screen, like art, thinking about, you know, a doctor or a lawyer or a accountant.
And I think that one of the issues is there are certain things that we don't have a lot of influence over with our kids or with the people around us. So personality characteristics, for example, you know, you can play around with them a little bit. But, you know, again, as Bob was saying, you know, you get three kids all from the same family, and they manifest these motivational characteristics in very different ways. And no matter what the parents try, it doesn't have that much of an influence in the long run. But then I think that there's this issue of expectations that I do think gets set by the people around us. Expectations about are you going to go to college? You know, so for me, as the child of two parents, both with master's degrees, it was a foregone conclusion that I was going to go to college. In fact, one of the most vicious arguments I had with my mother ever was during my freshman year of college. She was saying, promise me you'll go to graduate school. And I said, I can't promise that. But the amazing thing was, that's the argument we were having, right? Promise me you'll go to graduate school right after you go to college. That was the nature of the argument. That's setting a particular set of expectations, as opposed to families where, you know, you're the first generation ever to go to college, and that is not the expectation at all. So there are expectations like that. There are expectations about career paths. There are expectations about what constitutes the career you should have. And those do have an influence, because now you begin, if you're going to do something that doesn't fit the narrative that's been set for you by parents and peers and other family, that takes a certain amount of self-determination, right, to be willing to do that. And some people are more prone to buck that trend than others. And so So I think that those expectations are something that do get set by the people around you, and those really can have a profound influence on what you choose to do.
The work that we're doing at KUT with the show and this book kind of bridges this gap between the world of academia and then kind of pop culture or the public. And there are there are different ways of kind of understanding your position within those two worlds, and also kind of what they represent and what type of work you need to be doing in the institution versus out in the public. And maybe talk just a little bit about how you see those divisions and then how you also envision unification between that, because what we really want is to kind of like educate everybody, but the institution is what it is.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying this. You know, I mean, universities are great places. And you know, if you think about it, I mean, the University of Texas now has a budget of like $2.6 billion, I think. That's with a B. And you think, I never get over the fact that I walk across campus and I look at all these buildings and all these people and say, somebody built all of this so people could learn something. I mean, that is just amazing, you know? And I'm still amazed. I mean, I'm 62 years old. I'm still amazed at that. And I've been here for 32 years almost. But the thing that's interesting about that to me, right, is that when you're in a place like this and you talk to people who read the same papers that you read and are working on the same questions you're working on and are trying to figure out really difficult things that are really challenging, it's easy to get in the weeds, you know, with very challenging, complicated things that are not immediately explainable to people who haven't spent all that time in the weeds. And I think, you know, what art values and what I value is, for whatever reason, our capacity to talk to people out of the weeds, right? To be able to think about, okay, we're in the weeds, we know what's going on in the weeds. But the thing is, that's only going to be meaningful to the general population if everybody sees that that's something that they can be interested in and that they can understand. And, you know, the reason I think about this so much, I mean, our obligation as an institution is, and this is going to sound a little hokey, but it's true, is to prepare citizens to live in a democratic society, which means they should know some stuff. Right. And what's interesting to me is every student, and probably all of you in this room who have gone to college, took a course in something for non-majors. And you thought, good God, what am I, you know, chemistry, you know. And I'm thinking, that's not good, right? Because when that happens, when you take a course in chemistry for non-majors, and what you learn from that course is, I don't like chemistry and I can't understand chemistry, now you're going to be a voting citizen in a free society. And you're ceding the responsibility of understanding something to somebody else. Now, I don't want to sound too highfalutin about this, but it seems to me that the things that we understand about psychology, which are many and are inherently interesting, you don't have to convince people to be interested in it, it's interesting, right? Are things that are worth communicating to people. And I think, you know, Art and I both value, and Rebecca is the person who makes all this happen, are opportunities to convey those things to people who are not down in the weeds.
And I think that there's an interesting question about the appropriate division of labor for this kind of communication. And I think, you know, on the one hand, I mean, I think, you know, both Bob and I started our careers doing research and writing lots of papers where the weeds were crucial. And separating the weeds from the non-weeds was an abundance. We've tortured this metaphor, but
we're gonna ride this one to death.
That's right.
It off the cliff.
There we go. Yeah, and so that's what we were tasked with doing. Right, was writing a lot of papers that were advancing our respective areas of research, and then the question becomes: okay, so then we recognize, gosh, it would be awfully nice if other people knew some of the stuff we knew. Who in the world is going to do that? And there's two classes of people who have sprung up to fill that gap. On the one hand, I think there's people like Bob and I who are scientists trying to write in this space. And then there's a lot of people who are really great writers, much better than we are, who aren't necessarily that well versed in the science. I mean, the kind of Malcolm Gladwells of the world. And the question is, who should be doing this? And I've come to believe more and more over the years that it really does need to be the scientists. That one of the values of spending all that time in the weeds is that you actually understand the lay of the land extraordinarily well. You're not hearing things third hand, and you're not really willing to bend the data in the service of a story that you want to tell, right? The what we know about the field is paramount, and then we're trying to communicate that sometimes in all of its gory complexity. And I kind of prefer that to the approach of someone who's a very gifted storyteller who tells stories in the vicinity of the science.
And you know, I think Art and I have a particular advantage because our expertise has to do with human behavior and human thinking and human feeling. I don't know if you were paying attention today, but the Nobel Prize in physics was announced today. And I have to say, I was really struck by the person at the Nobel committee who was announcing the award. It was on topology, and topology is the science of surfaces. And so he held up a donut and a pretzel and a dinner roll. and said, this is what topology is about. This thing has a hole. This thing has two holes. This doesn't have any hole. Now, come on. That was spectacular. But the thing is, you can sort of enjoy the cleverness of that, but it's not going to help you raise your children, right? But I mean, the
things that... Give them a donut.
Right. But I think the things that we get to think about, because we just happen to be so insightful as, you know, 18-year-olds that we chose the right fields, that we actually get to study and spend a lot of time thinking about human beings and the way we operate. And I think most of us, not only as a result of, you know, latent narcissism, but because of our just own wanting to know why we do what we do, find it interesting to see things that are under the surface that may be invisible without someone exposing them in some way.
Which kind of gets us back to what we opened up with, was the section that you read, which is like thinking that we know how we're behaving and why we're doing what we're doing. And why do we think, we all have brains, we think we know how they work. Why do we delude ourselves into believing that we understand that?
Well, you know, there's, I mean, for one
why
thing,
don't
because
we know? We all have brains.
Because yeah. there's no particular survival value in actually being right about the way the mind works. Right? I mean, you know, that is actually
cross-stitch that on a pillow. That's worth saving. That's
true. I mean, no, because you know what the brain is doing is we're telling stories that are going to be valuable for us to be able to move forward in the world. So, for example, we often believe things that aren't true. We sort of believed, "Oh yeah, we could do this book." And then that became, you know, the myth that we told ourselves until we finished the book, right? I mean, and I think we do that sort of thing a lot. We tell ourselves all kinds of stories that are going to be helpful for us to get through the next day. And the fact that the brain actually works in a very different way doesn't really matter to that, for that aim of what the brain is doing. And so it's only when we then turn it inwards and say, well, I wonder if we could tell a story about how the brain operates, that we then tell this fantastic fiction about how the brain works until there's data.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about consciousness, you know, I mean, there's really no clear rationale for why consciousness evolved over millennia of evolution. But it provides remarkable opportunities for human beings. And it also provides remarkable opportunities for self-delusion. And not just to protect our egos or those kinds of things. I mean, we, from inside of our own consciousness, it really feels like this is how the world works. Stuff happens out there. Our sense receptors receive all of that. We process it in some way. We make a decision, and then we act. It really feels like that. But actually, almost all the time, that's not what's happening. There are aspects of our brain that are operating below our conscious awareness that are leading us to behave in certain ways, to feel certain ways, decide certain things that we're not really aware of. Now, a lot of times, that's not consequential, because if we're in an environment where we're pretty well protected and we're surrounded by people who are nurturing and helpful and we have resources available to us, that self-delusion is inconsequential. But when we're having to make decisions that are challenging, and the things that we need to consider to make an intelligent decision are not easily considered, well, now it's important to think about that, right? I mean, we you know, going through most of our daily lives, I mean, that little snippet of the chapter we read was about decision making. I mean, think about the thousands of decisions you've made today. I mean, just unbelievable, right? And there would be no way for you to survive through a day without utter exhaustion if you had to consciously, volitionally make every one of those decisions. So many of them are happening, they're running off on autopilot, right? Now, the reason that gets us into trouble is that some of the things that our primitive brains are leading us to do on autopilot are not in the long term advantageous.
Yeah. In part, of course, because our modern environment has lots of decisions we have to make that didn't exist at all in that evolutionary environment, some of which are things like coffee makers, but some of which are, you know, are the opportunity to, you know, buy fries for dinner, for example, which, you know, load yourself up with salt and fat and sugars for dinner, which if you had to go hunt that stuff and gather it, would have taken a lot of effort. But we can just kind of walk up the street and, you know, buy it.
Make it happen.
So make it so.
We want to open things up for questions because I know you have tons of questions for the guys. But I want to talk about one more thing because we are talking about and discussing this book, which is this physical object. And I was having a conversation with some friends of mine yesterday because I'm working on a documentary for another show on Stuart Hall. And it starts at a bookstore. And the bookstore is in London, Houseman Bookstore. And they're selling Stuart Hall's books. And they have these little annotations in them, you know, little notes, little signings and things like that. And we were discussing why it's so important to have this book, you know, in this age of, you know, digital reproduction and mass deception, as Walter Benjamin would say. Like, we, you know, what is the importance still of this object? Or maybe not importance, but how does it interact with our brain to hold this physical object?
Sure. Stuff is great. I mean,
that's going on a pillow
but,
also.
But, you know, well, because we also have this belief that we have stored away a lot of information, and then on a whim, we can just call it back up. But in fact, the brain is not just this repository of stuff that we can call up whenever we want it. It's not like it's like Google, I guess, in the sense that you have to ask it the right question in order to get the information you want. And so really, in order to get stuff out of the brain, information out of the brain, you have to expose it to the right retrieval cue, which is a bit of information that is associated with the information you're trying to get out. Now, if you don't have anything in the world in front of you, it can be very difficult to get back to the information you want, because now you have to generate the entire chain that gets you back to the information you're hoping to get. One of the beauty of physical objects in general is their ability to call to mind all sorts of things that you may not have intended to remember in that moment until you were confronted with that particular object, which is why buying a memento on a vacation can be a great thing, because now that memento stands in for the vacation in the sense that by looking at it, you suddenly remember where you were when you bought it and what you were thinking about and what it was like to be in that place at that time. So physical objects have this tremendous power to reach into memory. And books are fascinating because not only is the book itself an object that can carry memories with it, but by reading that text, that exact text again, you can often then call to mind not just, oh, I remember this story from the past, but also I remember where I was and what I was thinking when I first read this. And you can sometimes even recognize how much you yourself have changed from the first time you read something to a later time when, as a younger person reading something, you might have interpreted it in one way. And then you get a different interpretation later, and you can actually juxtapose those, which would be very hard to do just from a train of thought that you were running in your own head. But by having a physical object that can reach into memory, it has that kind of power.
And I think we underestimate how much all of our memories are bound to the context in which they were formed in the first place, right? I mean, so our memory of this event is not only just the three of us here talking and there are people out there listening and those kinds of things, but there's a physical environment here, there's a temperature in the room, all these things are part of the memory. And when you think about holding a book, now I'm an electronic guy, you know, I read on Kindles and my iPad and that kind of thing. My daughter loves books. She loves to actually touch physical books. And I get that, right? Because part of the memory is the physicality of the book, which is different when you're reading it on a reader, because that reader can go anywhere. I can read it on my phone. I can read it on my iPad. I can read it on my Kindle. I'm embarrassed that I have all those things. But if you think about a physical book, you're touching this thing. And the memories that you've created related to that thing are attached to the physical object that in a way that they can't be if it's just, you know, images on a screen.
And I think we forget sometimes, too, how much of an activity reading is. You know, like I remember reading books and then being interrupted by something, or reading books on a bus and knowing the smells of the bus and what I was like looking out at, you know, and things like that. I mean, reading also gives us a sense of place and space where we can create memories.
Yeah. And one of the other nice things about reading is it's slow. I mean, it, you know, relative to lots of other things. I mean, you know, our show is 7.5 minutes and you're doing usually something else while you're, you know, while you're listening to it. And you know, sitting down at the TV, you know, you're watching something for an hour, or maybe if it's a movie, 2 hours, or these days, I guess if you're binge watching something, it might be 10 hours. But still, you know, it happens in this kind of, you know, real finite space and time. And one of the beauties of books is, I mean, a good book, you can live with it for several weeks, you know, and so there's a whole period of your life that can be wrapped up in it in a way that often doesn't happen with a lot of other media.
Yeah, and I'll just say one thing about that, because Art mentions the slowness of reading. The other thing I mentioned is the quiet of reading. You know, I mean, life is loud, you know, there's just stuff making noise all the time, you know, and to be in a quiet room with a book is a precious thing. And I think many people who think, you know, they don't have time for that because they could be busy accomplishing something, fail.
I could be listening to this
yeah,
right. While I'm working
and sewing. That rather than in doing that, that actually that quiet time is actually healthy for the way our brains function. And actually the way we'll function after that quiet time is in many instances, I should say in most instances, superior to what it would be if we were just kind of plowing through because that seemed like the, you know, hard worker thing to do.